how does being a Christian shape the trajectory and the purpose of your life? And I'm asking how, on a day-to-day basis, just on the street level where you live, what are you doing? What are you thinking? What are you being or becoming simply because you're a follower of Jesus? Or I could put it like this. Is your faith basically just fire insurance to get you to another place someday, somewhere? Or is your faith something that is actually impacting and transforming your everyday life here and now? I want to answer these questions from our text this morning. Now, if you're joining us, our text is jumping back to where Luke kind of started the story. Okay, so Luke started with this elderly couple named Zechariah and Elizabeth. Zechariah was offering the incense in the temple, in the holy place. An angel of the Lord spoke to him and said, "You're going to have this miraculous son. I know you're past childbearing years, but God himself is going to do this." And Zechariah doubted. He was struck deaf and mute. This whole time that his wife has now conceived and been pregnant, he has not been able to speak. And now we pick up our reading in Luke chapter 1 and verse 57. Now the time came for Elizabeth to give birth, and she bore a son. And her neighbors and relatives heard that the Lord had shown great mercy to her, and they rejoiced with her. And on the eighth day they came to circumcise the child. And they would have called him Zechariah after his father, but his mother answered, "No, he shall be called John." And they said to her, "None of your relatives is called by this name." And they made signs to his father, inquiring what he wanted him to be called. And he, that is Zechariah, asked for a writing tablet and wrote, "His name is John." And they all wondered. And immediately his mouth was opened and his tongue loosed. And he spoke, blessing God. And fear came on all their neighbors. And all these things were talked about through all the hill country of Judea. And all who heard them laid them up in their hearts, saying, "What then will this child be?" For the hand of the Lord was with him. And his father Zechariah was filled with the Holy Spirit and prophesied, saying, "Blessed be the Lord God of Israel, for he has visited and redeemed his people and has raised up a horn of salvation for us in the house of his servant David, as he spoke by the mouth of his holy prophets from of old, that we should be saved from our enemies and from the hand of all who hate us, to show the mercy promised to the fathers and to remember his holy covenant, the oath that he swore to our father Abraham, to grant us that we, being delivered from the hand of our enemies, might serve him without fear in holiness and righteousness before him all our days. And you, child, will be called the prophet of the Most High, for you will go before the Lord to prepare his ways, to give knowledge of salvation to his people in the forgiveness of their sins, because of the tender mercy of our God, whereby the sunrise shall visit us from on high, to give light to those who sit in darkness and in the shadow of death, to guide our feet into the way of peace." And the child grew and became strong in the spirit, and he was in the wilderness until the day of his public appearance to Israel. This is the word of the Lord. Now, you notice that this text that I read this morning contains both a narrative and this hymn of praise that Zechariah offers. It's a hymn that today is known as the Benedictus. And what I want you to see is that between this story and the song, we're seeing here four important truths about the salvation that Jesus has come to bring. We're going to see the catalyst of Jesus' salvation, the nature of Jesus' salvation, the purpose of Jesus' salvation, and then finally, the response to Jesus' salvation. Seattle, Washington, with its deep harbor and its plentiful forests, was a terrific place for a logging town in the mid to late 1800s. And actually, one of the city's founders, Henry Yesler, built the first steam-powered sawmill in the entire Pacific Northwest. Now, because lumber was so plentiful in the Pacific Northwest, obviously the entire region for many hundreds or thousands of square miles is just coniferous trees, virtually everything in that early town was built out of lumber. Now, The problem was it rained a lot in the Pacific Northwest, and the streets, as you can probably tell, got muddy from time to time. And the horse and buggies were sinking into the mud, and the city was so low where it was first built that the tides would actually come in and wash up several blocks into the city, again, making more mud and more problems. So someone had the bright idea of, well, we've got a sawmill, we've got tons and tons of sawdust and wood chips. We'll just keep throwing down more and more layers of sawdust and wood chips on top of the mud, and that'll keep us high and dry. Well, along with the mill came the production of turpentine, because you have to find something to do with all that resin from all those trees. And turpentine conditions the wood, protects the wood, preserves the wood a little bit. So there was a big plant that began producing turpentine. Now, one more thing about Seattle real quick. Back in this day, it said that there were about 20 to 30 men for every woman. And logging and the mill work was long and exhausting work, lifting these heavy logs all day long. So Seattle also had a number of saloons pouring lots of hard liquor. So you've got a superabundance of wood, sawdust, turpentine, and liquor. What could possibly go wrong? So, late 1800s, Seattle, the city, was literally a powder keg. It was just sitting there waiting for some kind of catalyst, some kind of spark. And that was provided on June 6, 1889, when a pot of glue in the workshop of Victor Claremont, woodworking, building furniture, that pot of glue boiled over. And as soon as that hot glue hit the turpentine-covered floor, the entire city of Seattle went up in flames. And here's the point of this illustration. When we begin the Gospel of Luke, I want you to understand that we are sitting on a similar situation to Seattle in the 1880s. And what I mean is, for hundreds of years, Israel has waited for a Messiah, and God has not been speaking to them. There's this period of prophetic silence. And so the people's expectation, each generation, is building and building and building. Maybe this will be the day. Maybe this will be the year. Maybe I will live in a generation when Messiah comes and redeems his people. And each generation then died with their hopes and dreams, not just going unfulfilled, but being dashed, being destroyed. And so when we come and we open the early pages of these Gospels, like the Gospel of Luke, we realize that all of this expectation and hope has morphed into frustration. And the people of God are this powder keg of anger and disappointment and frustration and even unbelief and despair. The cries of the nation are captured in Habakkuk's words, one of the minor prophets, who said, "Oh, Lord, how long shall I cry for your help and you will not hear, or cry to you violence and you will not save?" But then Luke's gospel begins suddenly with a catalyst. Luke's gospel begins very suddenly with a spark, that all this unbelief, all this anger, all this angst is sitting there, and something happens, like God drops a match and boom, okay, here we go. A revolution, a reversal is about to begin. Why? Now, you know, most religions in some form or another teach people, you basically need to somehow redeem yourself, save yourself, and reach out for God. You know, make yourself worthy of God through your performance, through your good deeds, through doing nice things, through showing love, or, you know, in some cases, even through showing violence and destroying the supposed enemies of your supposed God. But Christianity is fundamentally different than essentially every other religion, because what Christianity says is that instead of us being told to reach up for God and make ourselves worthy of God and work up our own salvation, look back at Zechariah's words, verse 68. What is God doing? He says, "Blessed be the Lord God of Israel, for he has visited and redeemed his people and has raised up a horn of salvation for us." Okay, so here's the catalyst. Zechariah is saying God came and then God worked our salvation for us. The catalyst is this. The catalyst of our salvation is, first of all, God's presence. And second of all, related to that, God's power. He's saying God came, God visited his people. He looked, he remembered, he saw, but he also came physically. And Zechariah sees, if God is keeping his promise to me and to my wife to give us this miraculous son, then I know this other son that he's promised with Mary, you know, earlier in this pregnancy, standing here and me observing, there's a child growing in her womb as well. God is visiting his people to save. And that's really good news, guys. Because we could sit here forever on top this powder keg of anger and frustration and looking and hoping and dreaming and dying, and nothing would ever change. There would be no reversal. There would be no revolution of grace. But Zechariah gets it. He gets that the salvation isn't born out of our own attempts to reach out for God. Our salvation is born out of God's desire to reach out for us. It's his mercy and power that's doing this. Okay, that brings us to the nature of Jesus' salvation. And what I want you to note here is that actually much of Zechariah's hymn of praise now is going to be reflecting on different dimensions of Jesus' salvation. And I want to point out here that we tend to, even as Christians, have a very narrow view of salvation. Now, we tend to think of it on a personal level, don't we? God's coming to save me. God's coming to forgive my sins. And that's certainly true. You look at verse 77. Zechariah even says that. He says, we have the knowledge or the experience of salvation through the forgiveness of sins. Okay, so that's true. That's right. That's good. And we're grateful for that. My point is simply that the salvation of Jesus goes way beyond what even we as Christians are used to thinking. And rather than putting God in a box and saying salvation looks like this, let's let him speak for himself now, because I want you to see there are four other dimensions of salvation that are reflected just in Zechariah's song. The first of those is that salvation is rescue out of bondage. And you see this in verse 68, the word redeemed, the Lord has visited and redeemed. That word literally means God has liberated his people. And if you don't know what he's talking about, he goes down in verse 71 and then verse 74 again, where he talks about being saved or delivered from the hand of our enemies. Now, if you know the history of the Jewish people, you know that theirs is a history of bondage and conflict and war and oppression and servitude to all this list of other nations. And so what we hear in Zechariah's prayer is that he's believing with all his heart, if the Messiah is coming, if he's here, he's going to be this political and this even military liberator. He's going to come and he's going to fight our battles for us. He's going to deliver us from the hands of our enemies. But what's interesting is as we go through the story of Luke, if you don't know this already, Jesus is not going to be the kind of military and political leader that the people were typically expecting him to be. He's going to deliver from an enemy, several enemies, but very different enemies. And I love this because most of us are Gentiles in this room. Most of you are not from Jewish blood. Isn't it great news for us that Jesus did not come to say, yes, I'll fight for my people and I'll pit the Jews against the Gentiles and the Jews will win and you guys will lose. He didn't come to fight that kind of war. Jesus comes and says, OK, I see your bondage to idols. I see your bondage to sin, to temptation. I see your bondage to death. Nobody's escaping death. And in 1,000 different ways, as we work our way through this Gospel of Luke, we're going to read stories where Jesus is showing himself to be a bondage breaker, a liberator from all these different kinds of enemies, things that could sink us, things that could ruin us, like our fears, like our frustrations. And I want you to just think right now of something that enslaves you. Not looking around the room, not thinking, oh, these people from another political stripe, I think they're enslaved. Just what enslaves you? And maybe it's a particular sin that you keep going back to God in confession and prayer and saying, Lord, I'm done with this. I'm so tired of falling to the same stupid thing over and over and over again. I'm in bondage to it. Or maybe someone here is in bondage to anxiety or frustration or stress, and you just feel like I can never purge this from my life. It dominates my life. It controls my life. Well, isn't it good news that Jesus is not just saying you get to go to heaven when you die, but he's actually saying I came to rescue you from that bondage. I came to rescue you in such a way that right now, today, here, you can have freedom from and victory over that thing that you feel like controls you and dominates your life. By the way, I love the picture in verse 69. We're not used to this phrase, but he refers to Jesus as God's horn of salvation. So you picture, you know, over there it would have been cattle, but you picture here in Colorado like elk or moose. Their horns are their strength. You're talking about the business end of the animal when you're talking about the horns. And kind of by this metaphor, God is saying Jesus is the business end of my salvation. You need something done in your life. I'm sending not just his presence, I'm sending his power, and he will do it. So salvation is rescue out of bondage. Secondly, you see here in this prayer, this hymn, that salvation is also mercy out of trials. Now, we're used to using the word mercy maybe to mean leniency. You know, someone deserves a 20-year jail sentence and a judge says, you know, I'm going to show you mercy and I'm going to give you 2 years. That's leniency. The word here in verse 58, 72, 78, it doesn't mean leniency. He's not praising God. Thank you for being lenient with me. He's basically saying, here's stuff in my life so great, so awesome, I could never deserve it. And God gave it to me. So just generally speaking, he's using the word mercy 3 times in this song to refer to the undeserved kindness of God. And what he's saying is this is a part of God's salvation. Look at verse 58 where he uses this first. And the whole city, the whole region, the hill country of Judea, it says they're rejoicing on behalf of their friends Elizabeth and Zechariah. Why? Because they see God has shown them mercy. Now, what's the mercy in their case? Well, we've said it. They're sitting here waiting, hoping, praying, dreaming for they just want a child. Is that too much to ask of God who can do all things just to give us a baby? And the sun set on that dream. You know, they got way beyond childbearing years. And God shows up in mercy. And God says, you still want that child and I'm going to give it to you. I'm going to give him to you. I'm going to give you this baby, John. And he's not just going to be any boy. He's going to be the boy who is the forerunner of the Messiah. That's God's mercy. And they realize it. They realize we didn't do anything in our old age to deserve this gift. God did it. And by the way, that is an illustration. Zechariah and Elizabeth are an illustration of all the people of God in that age because they're all sitting waiting. And they all think that ship has sailed. We're not going to see it. And God shows up in mercy for all of his people. You're waiting for the fulfillment of your hopes and dreams and expectations. Let me rekindle that fire of hope because the Son is here who's going to live the life you should have lived. He's going to die the death you should have died. He's going to redeem you. He's going to set you free. He's going to bring you God's mercy. And so again, just by way of application, I want you to think in your life, where do I need mercy? And let me say generally, the more you think you deserve from God, I think the more angry of a person you're going to be. The more bitter, the more frustrated, the more stressed about what God is giving, the less you think you deserve. You know, if you're able to sit there and say, man, I'm a sinner saved by grace. I do not deserve anything. Really? I mean, I work hard. And in that sense, I feel like there's a give and take. But I don't deserve anything from the hand of God who sees every thought I've ever had. And if you think that way, you'll see mercy showing up in your life all over the place. Little good things or big good things that just because of the abundant kindness of God, God is not saying, well, wait till you get to heaven when you die. He's saying, I came here and now that you may have mercy so that you may have abundant kindness, stuff you didn't earn. Thirdly, we see that salvation is also light out of darkness. This is verses 78 and 79. Zechariah says here, he says, the sunrise, and he's using a metaphor here for Jesus. He's saying the sunrise shall visit us from on high. So he's coming down to us. Why? To give light to those who sit in darkness and in the shadow of death. Now, darkness even today is a common metaphor for stuff we like to avoid. We say, well, everyone else in my company knew this, but I was kept in the dark. Well, what is darkness a metaphor for? It's a metaphor for your lack of knowledge about something, your lack of understanding about something. Or we say, you know, it was a dark time in my life. Well, what are we saying? We're saying it's probably a difficult, it was a painful time. It was a time characterized by fear or anxiety or unknown. Or, you know, we associate it with gloom and doom. We associate it with judgment. We associate it with death. I've told you before about some of my experiences of camping in the mountains of Colorado. I haven't told you this one. One time, it was my first full year out here. I go to this little cabin in the Indian Peaks Wilderness, and I'm sleeping in this cabin by myself. And all night long, I hear scratching on the logs of the outside of the cabin. So it's pitch dark. I mean, you can walk out and look up above the tree canopy and see all these stars, but they're far enough away. It is not bright down here. You see nothing down here. And so all night long, like, what does your mind do when you're out there and you hear scratching against the bark on the cabin? Well, I'm thinking, and I didn't know at this time that there were no grizzly bears in the state of Colorado. I thought, my word, of all places, like my first time camping here in Colorado, there's a grizzly bear scratching on my cabin. He's probably going to come through the window and eat me. And my friends camping next door in this other camp, they're not even going to know that I'm gone. You know, and I wake up the next morning and there's a gentle breeze blowing and these sticks are kind of scraping together and this little chickadee is chirping. And you're like, oh, OK, you know, in the light, it feels very different. It's like this sound was not a bear. It was like a finch or something. You know, it's embarrassing. But what Zechariah is doing here is he's saying darkness is an illustration of all of our lives before Jesus. Because it's just the unknown. It's just, well, I think I believe this and I sure hope I'm right. Or there's the darkness of fear. There's the darkness of judgment hanging over me. Like my view of God is that he's very oppressive and he's just waiting to judge me and do bad things to me. And what Zechariah says here is, yes, but the coming of Jesus is like light penetrating into all of that darkness. You know, if you've been camping, you have that fear. There's no greater sight than the next morning seeing that eastern sky go from black to a very dark blue. And you're like, OK, here it comes. The sun's coming up and pretty soon it's going to be an explosion of color. And I'm going to feel like my life has turned a corner and I'm saved. You know, I made it through the night. I'm safe. And he's kind of saying this is the salvation of God. And you look into your own heart in this moment and say, where is the darkness? Maybe it's the darkness of fear or anxiety. Maybe it's the darkness of this kind of stress or just an unknown thing in your life. Well, it's unknown to you, but it's known to God. And part of God's salvation is to say, I want to bring my light of salvation into all those little crevices in your life that you've kept where there's still a little bit of darkness hanging out. And I want to shine the light there, too. And bring hope and bring truth and bring encouragement and bring healing. Salvation is light out of darkness. Finally, what we see here in this prayer, this hymn, is that salvation is peace out of conflict. And this is the last phrase of verse 79 where he says, God has brought this light into your darkness. Why? To guide our feet into the way of peace. Now, at the most basic level, peace is simply the absence of conflict. But this word, like the Hebrew word shalom, goes deeper than that. It's not just a ceasefire. It is the active presence of basically everything good. OK, so it is the presence of harmony, is the presence of tranquility, is the presence of total wellness, you could say. And I want you to just back up before the coming of Jesus. And this helps us understand, well, OK, what kind of peace did Jesus bring? Well, what kind of conflict did the first Adam bring? Now you go all the way back to the Garden of Eden and Adam and Eve sin against God. And immediately, if you know the story, they introduce all kinds of conflict into the story, right? That weren't there before. Suddenly there's conflict between them and God when they had fellowship before. Suddenly there's conflict between husband and wife and interpersonal relationships just start going sideways really fast. And you only make it one generation before a guy kills his brother. Okay, that's interpersonal conflict. You see conflict between Adam and Eve and nature, that thorns and thistles are growing up and the ground itself is cursed. And you see conflict within their own soul, that they're experiencing something in their conscience that they never felt before. And that's conflict. And so what he's saying here is that if Jesus has come to guide our feet into the way of peace, first and foremost, that has to mean peace with God. We have a right relationship with God. And again, that's not just, okay, God's calling a ceasefire. That is God saying, I will be your friend. I will be a father to you. We'll be family. Active wellness. But beyond that, Jesus is coming to give comprehensive peace, comprehensive harmony into our lives. And wherever there's conflict, and we think about our lives even now, and we say, okay, who is that conflict with? And some of you even know, walking in here this morning, my conflict is with my spouse. My conflict is with this person that we used to be really good friends, and something has happened. I may not even understand exactly what, and things are sideways. Conflicts with a neighbor who can't get his stuff off my yard, or, you know, whatever his deal. Conflicts with a coworker. Conflicts with this other group of people who are not like me, and they rub me the wrong way. Okay, that's the who. What kind of conflict is it? Is it a spiritual conflict? Is it a financial conflict? Is it merely social, relational, political? What is the conflict? And what would it look like for Jesus to guide your feet into the way of peace with that person, with that specific conflict? Are you asking God to do that for you? Again, not just, I'm glad I punched my ticket, I go to church every once in a while, I get to go to heaven when I die, but saying, Lord, I'm asking you, will you bring peace into this specific conflict in my life today? Will you bring your light into this specific darkness? Will you bring your mercy, your grace, your healing into this specific thing today? I'm asking you to transform my life today. Okay? And in meditating on this hymn this week, the words that kept playing over and over in my mind. Many of you know the great hymn, Great is Thy Faithfulness. But there's a line in there that says, All I have needed, Thy hand hath provided. And that's the nature of Jesus' salvation. It's not that He gives you some and kind of starts things off down the right path and says, okay, now I'm handing this off to you, now you do the rest. Or I'll fix this part of your life, but there are all these other things that, you know, you just have to get to heaven when you die, and then things will be better. Well, of course things will be better when you're perfected and sin has been banished forever. Of course. But do you believe this hymn, like Zechariah's hymn, that everything I need for life and godliness and peace and light today is provided by the hand of a good God who sent His Son? That's the nature of our salvation. And by the way, I say all this that those are four things that I gave you this morning about the nature of salvation. But I want you to picture salvation is like a diamond. Salvation is not one dimensional. It's not flat. It's not even three dimensional or four dimensional. Salvation is like a diamond where God has graciously taken this beautiful stone and cut all these different facets into it from all these different angles, so that against the backdrop of the blackness of our sin and the world that we live in, there's light coming through all these different angles, and it's beautiful and it's radiant and it's brilliant. And God just invites us, take my salvation, take that diamond and just keep turning it over and keep looking at it under different lights and from different angles. And you will see that I am incomprehensibly good, incomprehensibly light, incomprehensibly beautiful. All right. That brings us to point three, the purpose of Jesus' salvation. Now, kind of what I want to point out here is that we talk all the time. I mean, we are a gospel-centered church. So we talk all the time about the fact that Jesus saves and that Jesus alone saves. We even talk all the time about the nature of His salvation. So the stuff I said this morning, if you've been here any length of time, you hear that sort of thing all the time. But here's a question that goes beyond that. Why all of this? Okay, so the forgiveness, the mercy, the light, the peace, all of that, why? And what I mean is, what is God intending to do in us by giving us those things? What is He ultimately intending to accomplish? I'll put it another way. And I'll put this up here. I invite you to finish this sentence. The purpose, the point of Jesus' salvation is so that we might what? I mean, you may literally put the point of Jesus' salvation is so that we might go to heaven when we die. The point of Jesus' salvation is so that we might feel intellectually and morally superior to other people who believe other things. The point of Jesus' salvation is so that we might believe that God wants us to be happy and he's willing to do anything to make that a reality in our lives. OK, so by the way, those are wrong answers. But I'm just inviting you to put what you think the answer is. What is the purpose? Do you stop and think about this in your day to day life? What is God trying to do with all this? If my life has a trajectory, if my life has a purpose, because I prayed a prayer, because I committed to following Christ, then what is that direction? What is that purpose? Let's go back to the song. You know, Zechariah actually answers this question. He says, why has God sent his son to redeem sinners? Why is Jesus visiting and redeeming his people? Verse 71, so that we should be saved from our enemies. And you say, OK, so why? I mean, so what's the point of that? So you're redeeming us so that we can be saved from our enemies. So why? Well, verse 74, so that being delivered from the hand of our enemies, we might serve him without fear in holiness and righteousness before him all of our days. Did you catch that? He's saying, why did Jesus visit? Why did God come down and humble himself and do this thing for us? Why did he set us free? And it says right here, so that being made holy and righteous, we might worship and serve Christ now and forever. He says, that's why. And by the way, I give you both of these statements because both of those statements are incredibly important. And the second of those statements, which is what we think of as the why, is actually dependent on the first part of that. Most of you know this. You were made, you were created, you were fashioned to worship and serve Jesus Christ. In the famous Westminster Catechism, the question that most of you know, what is the chief end of man? What is the ultimate goal of mankind? Answer, man's chief end is to glorify God and to enjoy him forever. Do you know if you accomplish virtually nothing else in your life but worshiping and enjoying God through Jesus, your life is a huge success? And if you go out of here today and you build skyscrapers and you close deals and you teach classes and you facilitate this and you cut the grass and you do all these things and you raise compliant, moral, ethical children and you don't worship and enjoy Jesus, you've accomplished nothing. I want you to imagine an ESPN interview, ESPN Sports. OK, a couple of you didn't know that. Guy runs around on the basketball court for four straight quarters, plays every minute. At the end of the game, he comes over and the ESPN guy is interviewing him. And the ESPN guy says, that was the most interesting game, so-and-so. You ran around for 48 minutes. You scored no points. You had no assists. You blocked no shots. You had no steals. You just ran around. And the guy points at his watch and he says, yeah, but my Fitbit says I got in my 10,000 steps for the day. Boom. Bam. What do you think of that? Well, you'd be like, I mean, that's quite an accomplishment. I mean, in 48 minutes, you got in your 10,000 steps for the day. That's, I mean, good for you. But you missed the point. It is a basketball game. And you need to score points and you need to help your teammates score points and you need to get the ball back and play defense. It's not about how many steps you took. In other words, activity does not equal success. And just because you have a flurry of activity going on in your life, and close friends and I talk about this all the time, it seems like the thing to say now is that we're all over busy and stressed. But do you know that we are missing the point just as much as that basketball player when we're like, boom, I did this and I did this and I did this and I did this and I've got the record to prove it right here on my watch. It's like, but that's not the point of your life. So what's the hang up with us worshiping and enjoying Jesus? What's the hang up with living as if that's actually the purpose of our life? And we get to the end of the day and say, you know what? There are a lot of things that didn't happen today. And I'm disappointed in that, but I'm okay. because God providentially brought these other opportunities into my day, and I pursued that to worship and enjoy Him. And the hang up is that all of us, myself included, we are naturally, instinctively inclined to worship and serve other things. Many of you, I know all about your workout. I know all about the Broncos. I know all about snowboarding and skiing and hiking and camping and craft beer and what you think of your own reputation and vocation and kids and careers and politics and opinions. And I know what you think makes you feel good, even if it's bad for you. I know what you think is bad, even if it's good for you. I know that because that's what you talk about. That's what you seem to worship and enjoy more than almost anything in your life. The problem, the hang up, is that we don't naturally, instinctively love and worship and serve Jesus. And that's why, friends, this first part here is so cool and so awesome that I said, we are not going to get here. We are not going to worship and serve Jesus Christ unless someone does something for us that's transformative and restorative in our hearts, where we're like, okay, now I'm clean. Now my heart is washed. Now my affections, my attention, my priorities, my goals have been restored and made right. And that's what Jesus has done for me. And that's what Zechariah is saying right here. He's saying, because Jesus, you have made us holy. You have declared us righteous when we're not. Practically, we're not. Positionally, we are, because He says it's true. So because you're washing me and cleansing me and pursuing me and shaping me, now I'm free to live for what you've called me to live for. Now I have the power within me to do it because it's your power at work. And again, I'll say this because this is so important. You can accomplish all kinds of impressive and noteworthy things in your life and it amount to nothing, because the purpose of your life is to worship and serve and enjoy Jesus. The reason He came and lived the life that you should have lived, the reason He died on the cross, yes, heaven. But what about all the days between here and then? Are you going to let God shape you then? That's the purpose. Finally, the response. The response to Jesus' salvation, and I've already begun to transition to this final point, but let me just show you three quick, simple things from Zechariah and Elizabeth's lives. When God steps into human history and shines light into their darkness, the very first response you see, not only from them, but from all their friends who knew their story, the very first response, and an instinctive response, it's like I talked about a couple weeks ago. You throw a rock at a pond, what happens? It hits the pond and makes a splash. When Jesus comes into the world and you see His light, it hits the pond, and what happens? Wonder and amazement happen. They instinctively, naturally happen. You look at this in verse 63. The word wonder means that all these neighbors, they're astonished. They're amazed. They're like, I mean, I don't know how old Elizabeth was, in her 70s, in her 80s. And they're like, wow. Like, this was not a difficult thing. This was an impossible thing that God has done. Their mouths drop open. And verse 66, notice it says they're all storing this up in their heart. As they understand the story, as they hear it, as they go see for themselves, yeah, Elizabeth really had a baby. She's like nursing this kid. How is this possible? Well, verse 66, they're all looking at John, this baby, and saying, what then will this child be? Because they know God's doing something special with him. They're amazed. Are you amazed at the grace of God? Amazed. Are you amazed that God stepped out of safety and security and control and relinquished that in humility and was pulverized on a cross to set you free and to bring you light and to end your conflict and to bless your life here and now and forever? It's the best good news the world has ever heard. And yet I feel like sometimes, and I'm talking about the worldwide scene, or at least certainly America, I feel like we're surrounded by legions of the unjazzed. Christians who are so apathetic. That whole story of grace and forgiveness and mercy and justice meeting and kissing at the cross and transforming our lives. It's just like, yeah, I know. And I'll be there one day. But I got stuff to do right now. I got a life to live right now. And my prayer is that as we work through this Gospel of Luke, that story after story after story is like a catalyst in your heart, stoking this fire and this passion for Jesus Christ, where you are so in awe of what Jesus did and what Jesus is doing still today, that it leads you into the second thing. Because if you're amazed by anything, do you know what you do instinctively? Is what Zechariah and Elizabeth did. Wonder and amazement always lead to proclamation and praise. And you notice this in the story, that praise and this hymn is Zechariah's spontaneous response to receiving this grace of God in his family's life. You know, remember, he's been deaf and mute since he doubted the promise. Now the child has been conceived. And he's maybe thinking all along, yes, but this is a high-risk pregnancy. You know, Elizabeth's going to miscarry. This is not going to happen. An 80-year-old woman or however old, you don't carry a baby all the way through. And then it happens. And she delivers this healthy baby boy. And he still can't even speak. Why? Because God has fulfilled his word. But God had a word for Zechariah. Do you remember what it was? He said, I'm going to do this for you. And when it happens, what are you supposed to do? You're supposed to name him John. So the eighth day, they roll into this little ceremony. The child is circumcised and everybody's looking at mom and dad. Elizabeth says, because she can talk, his name's John. Everybody blows up. What? What are you talking about? Zechariah, I mean, this is an incredible kid. You're going to name, he should be Z Jr. And he's like, no, John. And by the way, this is really cool because in the Greek, when Zechariah takes this tablet and writes, he literally writes, John is his name. He solves it with the first word. He's not waiting. He's not like, oh, maybe we'll call him John. He says, John is his name. And then suddenly his tongue is loosed and his mouth is open. And what comes pouring out is pent up praise. C.S. Lewis says, we delight to praise what we enjoy. He says it's always true. If you enjoy something, you're going to praise it to other people. And you know what's interesting? I love the Broncos, so I know that there are people here that you're not even sports fans. That doesn't stop me from boring you with my story about the play, because I enjoy something. And many of you do this with each other. You know, you're like, oh, man, you got to try this craft beer. It'll change your life. This new apricot lavender scrub from Rodan and Fields blew my mind. Like, you've got to try it, you know, and you're going through the things that you really enjoy. Maybe it's a new workout you found and you're like, you've got to do this. And you're like, my idea of a workout is, you know, one sit up in the morning to get out of bed and then I'm done and I'm back down. OK, that's my workout. You don't care. And you don't care that those other people don't care, because if you're in awe of something, if you're enjoying something, you spontaneously praise it. And the one place we check ourselves is with our spirituality. The one place where we hold back is we're like, well, people don't really want to hear that. I don't want to be thought of as this. I don't want to burn a bridge. And I just think, oh, that we could do this with Jesus in the gospel, where our enjoyment of him. And by the way, you know, people like this, you're like, I don't care about your thing, but I love seeing you enjoy it. Like that smile on your face and how you lean forward and your heart starts beating faster and you're talking about your thing. Like, you and I both know you don't care, but I can see it's coming from a heart of genuine enjoyment of that thing. And I think more non-Christians or not yet Christians would be more okay with us talking about Jesus that way. Not from a moral high horse, but just from, I enjoy this Jesus and this grace. Let me tell you what he did this week. And it's coming from a place that's genuine, that's authentic. It's just overflowing your cup and spilling on the lives of other people. That would have a different effect than what we tend to do if we do anything at all. So response number two, proclamation and praise. Finally, the last response here I see is a journey in countercultural obedience. And where I see this in the story is that actually what Elizabeth and Zechariah do in naming their son John, I mean, the reason there's so much pushback is this is a big cultural faux pas. You don't just go cherry pick a name from somebody else's family back then. Like, he should be Zechariah Jr. or he should be, you know, at least some kind of family name. So why does Zechariah and Elizabeth break a time-honored tradition? Why do they swim upstream against culture? Why do they, knowing that they're about to offend friends and family, Why do they do it anyway? John is his name. The only reason is because God told them John is his name. And this, by the way, is going to be indicative of the rest of the life of this man, John the Baptist. He's going to swim upstream against culture. He's going to follow Jesus on the way to the cross. He himself will be martyred for swimming upstream against culture. But you try to tell me that in this life that God has given us here on planet Earth, that God wants Christians doing something other than living, embodying, counter-cultural lives. You are not saved to live and think and talk and vote just like everyone else. You're not. Our church is called Grace City. Do you know why? One of the main reasons is because we should be an alternate city within the city. And people should look at this city, this community, and say, that's grace, that's justice, that's mercy, that's forgiveness, that's reconciliation. They look imperfectly so, obviously, but they're trying to look like Jesus. And they're obedient to his word, even when nobody else is, and even when it doesn't make sense. And here's what I love maybe most about this text this morning. So you see the title's A Tale of Two Sons, and we've not really talked about that much. The key question of the entire text, I think, is verse 66. When everybody's looking at this miraculous one boy that's born, John, and they're saying, what then will this child be? And you could read the rest of the story and say, that's weird. John or Zechariah didn't really answer the question. Because everybody's asking, what's he going to be? You notice immediately Zechariah, to answer the question, what is my child going to be? Let me talk to you about Jesus. What he's saying is, my son's story is so wrapped up in Jesus Christ. There's no way to understand who my son is going to be and who my son is without talking about Jesus. And I think, man, that's the story I want in my life. That, you know, you come to my funeral someday and it's like, what then was Matt Hand? And you plug in your name. And it's like, well, we can't really talk about Matt today because his life was about someone else. A tale of two sons, a tale of two lives, but really it's one because they become one with this kind of wholehearted surrender. Where John is saying, God, if that's what you want my life to be about, then I'll go around in camel hair, scratchy stuff on my body, and I'll eat locusts and honey, and I'll be a little eccentric, and I'll be a little weird, and I'll be a little countercultural, and I'll proclaim the message of forgiveness that you want me to proclaim, and I'll baptize people in your name. I'll do whatever you want. Because I don't want people to get to the end of my life and be able to make sense of my life apart from Jesus. My life, your life, should make absolutely no sense apart from Jesus. People should say, how in the world is that person that generous? I used to know that guy. He was crazy, selfish, proud, arrogant. He was a megalomaniac. Now he's like the first one on his knees washing somebody else's feet. What in the world happened? He said, I can't tell you my story without talking to you about Jesus. And that's where I land this whole thing. And it's a story about Jesus' salvation. Again, the catalyst of it, the nature of it, the purpose of it, our response to it. Will you respond in this way where you say, I'm not waiting, Jesus, to just get to heaven when I die and let the celebration begin, find out the story's true. I don't want to live for myself another day praising and proclaiming the worthiness of something else besides Jesus. I don't want my life to make sense without Jesus. And I invite Jesus, Jesus, will you do that in me? Will you do that in us? For your sake, for your glory.